Hello and welcome to this British Journal of Surgery podcast. I'm Wendy Barnaby and today we'll be hearing about pancreas cancer. We'll be talking about papers in the October issue of the journal, and the leading article has been written by Mr. Keith Roberts, consultant liver and HPB surgeon at University Hospitals Birmingham. And he joins me now. Keith, thinking about surgery for pancreas cancer, it might be argued that surgery by itself has really gone as far as it can go, and that improvements in treatment need to come from other areas like chemotherapy and genetics. What do you think?
You're right. We haven't improved the outcome for patients with resectable pancreatic cancer over the past 40 years, which is remarkable when, you know, we compare progress with other tumour types. The chemotherapy is making progress, and we know that from the original SPAC study, without chemotherapy, patients had an 8% five-year survival. With a later study published last year, we see with combination gemcitabine and capecitabine, 28% survival at 5 years, which for this disease is very good. The big problem, though, with chemotherapy is the genetic landscape of these cancers. They're inherently resistant to many forms of chemotherapy, and one person's tumour is really quite different from the next. And so we haven't quite optimized the chemotherapy for patients. We are making progress, and the Precision Panc study from the group in Glasgow aims to define in individuals' genetic makeup and tailor their chemotherapy for them. You know, I hope that we will see progress in this area. On the side of this, we're seeing a big shift in interest to using neoadjuvant chemotherapy or downstaging chemotherapy. Initially, this was for patients with unresectable or locally advanced tumours, but we are seeing some quite remarkable results with the pathology of these tumours when they're removed, in terms of very low numbers of lymph node positivity, clear resection margins. And so the interest in neoadjuvant therapy or FOLFIRINOX therapy with or without radiotherapy is really gathering momentum. But the problem we have here is we don't have any high quality evidence to say whether we should be using this regime for resectable cancer as a neoadjuvant therapy, or whether we should use it as an adjuvant therapy. So there are a lot of unknowns, but at last, you know, there is progress on the horizon for patients with this disease.
Right, so neoadjuvant therapy, understanding the genetic landscape, seem to be the two main ways forward. What about treatment in high-volume centres?
It's well established that in complex surgery, outcomes are better in high-volume centres, and there are studies published in various countries, and we've analysed the data here in the UK, and high-volume centres have much lower mortality than low-volume centres. But what I would say is the problem with high-volume centres is the patients have to travel quite a long way, and they're usually seen at their local centre where investigations and diagnostics occur. They are then handed over to the specialist team in the central hospital. But that kind of dismantling of the pathway has slowed things down, and what we have seen and what we know is this tumor moves very quickly. So on one hand, centralization has been fantastic because it has improved mortality following the surgery, but it makes the pathway more complicated. And these, you know, I think what is increasingly being appreciated is these patients should progress rapidly from, you know, diagnosis to treatment. And we have level one evidence that says we should avoid things like biliary stenting. We can reduce complications by 50% if we do this. We also reduce costs of treatment. But, you know, for many hospital organisations or pathways, it's very difficult to deliver this because of centralisation.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Keith. Let's turn to Professor Stephen Wexner, Director of the Digestive Diseases Centre at the Cleveland Clinic in Florida, who has co-authored one of the other papers in the issue. Stephen, your article describes how colorectal surgeons set up a Twitter account to discuss colorectal surgery. Why do you think social media is important in communicating surgical research?
Social media allows us to, A, communicate with people around the globe with whom we would not normally interact, B, be exposed to material that's been released, important material for our respective specialties, that may not otherwise come across our desks, and see, I think it saves us a tremendous amount of time because of its instantaneous nature. So rather than waiting for something to come surface mail or slogging through emails and looking at emails, it's automatically there, often with a hyperlink or banner or some way to immediately access data, or at least a teaser of the data. So I think those are three main reasons.
What were most of the tweets about? I mean, I'm wondering if, for example, there were any new research collaborations that came as a result of them.
The tweets covered a wide variety of items. And yes, you're correct, Wendy. A lot of the information did relate to new research because some of the spikes that we experienced were during the ACP-GBI meeting in 2016 and again during the ESCP meeting in 2016. And it's interesting, as you look across figure two, on page 1471, what you see is that the number of tweets in colorectal surgery or about colorectal surgery continued to increase, kind of stable when people, I think, were becoming accustomed to Twitter during ASCRS and ACP-GBI. But by the time ESCP hit a few months later, far more people were engaged and the number of tweets significantly increased as that time progressed. And I think we're continuing to see that, although it's not part of the article, but I believe we're continuing to see that through 2017.
There are difficulties, though, aren't there? I mean, if you're tweeting from a conference live, you have to make sure that intellectual pre-publication property is protected, and also you don't want people tweeting information that hasn't been peer-reviewed.
Well, unfortunately, there's no way to limit people tweeting things that are not peer-reviewed, and that is one of the potential pitfalls of any social media platform, is none of the social media are peer-reviewed data. People post whatever they'd like to post, and some of the things are completely unrelated to surgery, medicine, or science in any way, and are strictly people opining about different positions and things. They may be completely social related. Some people digress and put things about sports, politics, whatever. I don't personally engage in any of those activities, but I know other of my colleagues do. So you've got to be careful, and then I think it becomes a matter of credibility, that if you can hyperlink peer-reviewed things, that's best. If you're at a meeting, the presentation on the podium, with the exception of an industry-sponsored symposium, the things being presented on the podium should, of course, have been peer-reviewed by the program committee. So they are peer-reviewed to that extent. They've not been peer-reviewed by an editorial board, but they have been peer-reviewed by a program committee.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, back to surgery. The issue reports on two randomized controlled trials on GI surgery, one from Sweden, which finds in favor of a scoring system in suspected appendicitis, and one from Denmark, which finds against the routine use of ultrasound during laparoscopic colorectal surgery. What, and very briefly, I'm afraid, would you say are the important messages from these papers for surgeons?
If I look at the two papers together, I get almost the same message, which is that we, just because we have this plethora of new and fancy and expensive technology available to us, we don't always improve clinical outcomes by routinely availing ourselves of that technology. So the ultrasound paper said, look, you rely on your clinical data and you rely on what you're seeing laparoscopically, and you proceed with your colorectal cancer resection. And the appendicitis paper similarly said, if we use good clinical judgment and we go ahead and employ this STRAPS score, we may be able to save on employing some technology in patients with suspected appendicitis. So there's really no substitute, despite all of this new technology, for good sound clinical judgment. Now, some of it may require an amalgamation of clinical endpoints to create a score, fair enough. But still, as the authors in the appendicitis paper point out, they're able to reduce diagnostic imaging and hospital admissions and therefore save money. So to me, I think that both of those papers went hand in hand with that similar kind of endpoint.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Stephen. And that's all we have time for. So thank you for listening and goodbye.